Wally, how complicated can an hour and a half flight be? Right, you know, you got a good airplane, you got a good pilot, and a short flight, and all of a sudden, you know, just a little trickle of oil has you making some pretty tough decisions.
As my friend Bob Martin says, you can go from abnormal to big trouble in just a moment, can't you?
And literally, you know, and here you are, right at the halfway point. There's no real good options leaping out at you. And, you know, the rational person in us says, you know, how big a deal is this? Well, I think those of us that have been around airplanes realize, you know, you really have a serious condition here. The potential for a very serious condition. And as you go through your options, you know, 1 through 4, well, continuing on, yeah, I can rationalize that. I can justify that. Going back, you know, I can rationalize and justify that. Or I can go down and shoot an approach to Cat 2 minimums. Do I really want to do that? But I think that we all agree with you that under the circumstances, that is your preferred option. But choosing a tough call, how many pilots out there are ready to shoot an approach to ILS minimums with a little bit of heat going on?
If you're not familiar with using that autopilot in the approach mode, you're probably going to get behind if you try to use it in this approach, and this is the time you surely don't want to be behind. So you need to be a proficient pilot with good equipment if you elect to take on a flight like this.
Bob, you know, you have a little bit of oil on the cowling, okay? And we can rationalize, justify, it's just a little bit of oil and it's only 40 minutes to fly. What are the range of possibilities here with that oil, and how do they affect our decision to go forward, go back, or go down now?
Well, I view this as follows. If it doesn't seem right, it's not right. We've got to review the range of possibilities, which extend all the way to an engine failure for lack of oil. And I think we've got, based on our lack of knowledge as to where this oil is coming from, we have to assume a potential engine failure is in the cards here. And I agree with Wally. You get the airplane on the ground immediately. Oakland looks like the best bet based on the quality of the facility and the runway, being that it's Cat 3 runway. The lighting is about the best you're going to get for this circumstance in a low IFR situation. And I would go for it without delay, as Wally described. Declare an emergency. Make your turn towards Oakland. Let ATC know what you're planning on doing, and you need to call the shots. Be sure ATC understands exactly what you're going to do. Remember, you're in a very busy area, and to get the service that you really need here, the declaration of the emergency is first off here. I think, though, that the pilot in this scenario got himself into this situation by not reviewing the options, as Wally alluded to earlier. Flying over an area of low IFR in a single-engine airplane, to me, is similar to flying over water, over forest, over mountainous terrain in a single-engine airplane. Your options are limited, and you should view it the same way and establish whether there is an alternate route that gives you more options.
And how about dealing with an unknown, okay, if we decide, you know, an option is, you know, just continuing on. But how much focus do we have? I mean, I suspect if a pilot says, all right, I'll just press on and I'll just watch it.
Well, there's going into denial here. You have a problem that needs to be dealt with. And from inside the cockpit, you're not easily able to determine where that oil is coming from or what the rate of oil loss is. Remember, in these engines, we probably are not talking about more than 10 quarts of oil. And it doesn't take long for 10 quarts of oil to leak out, even with a moderate leak. You'll be in big trouble when you get down to about 2-3 quarts of oil. And it's very late in the game then to try to do something about it.
And it's not, you know, extreme to think about. When you have oil out there, you're only a hiccup away from a fire, you know. And the most horrific thing that can happen to us in an airplane is a fire. There's certainly some urgency to getting this airplane on the ground. And that is the first decision I think we have to make. And that will allow us to set up a sequence that this is a problem you want to deal with on the ground, you know, not in flight. You know, then you can manage it. But an unknown situation is virtually impossible to manage. John?
I totally agree. I think most people would actually underestimate the seriousness of this. Did you think about it? Here you are. You're at 8,000 feet on top. You're looking at tops that are 6,000 feet below you, these benign, puffy little clouds that are filling the bay. There's a nice sunset off to the left. You're on autopilot. You got your nice big G1000 screens. Life's good, you know. You see a little drop and you're like, well, maybe it's just a little drop. It's no big deal. Most people would not realize how serious this situation can get, and I think would be sorely tempted to continue and to press on.
And you may not see any indications on your instrumentation until your oil is getting quite low. That oil temperature may hold in the normal range until you're down to 3 or 4 quarts of oil. And then elevated oil temperature, you don't have a lot left at that point.
The fact is you don't have much time when you start
seeing
those.
You don't have much time, right.
And it is, once again, unknown. You know, is the cap just loose? Is the cap off? Is there a line detached? Is it beginning to fail? You know, when it does blow, if indeed it is in the almost fail mode, and then you're dumping oil on a hot engine, wow.
And in my experience, oil leaks tend to present themselves on the side of the fuselage and on the underside, just based on the airflow through the engine compartment, which is over the top and then down through the cylinders.
Yeah.
So what you see on the windshield may be the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, and you're seeing a very small portion. It may be the underside of your airplane may be soaked in oil.
Right.
But, you know, getting back to John's point about declaring an emergency, first of all, pilots generally disdain the emergency option. And I am a strong advocate. You know, I'm going to get in trouble. There's going to be so much paperwork. And that's just a myth. The emergency declaration is a tool that pilots need to utilize when it's necessary to get safely on the ground. And in this case here, no one would criticize this pilot for declaring an emergency. And here you are, virtually overhead, a perfect place to put your airplane down. Great lighting, long runway, crash rescue support, all the stuff you want to turn your stressful situation into a non-event.
But when you do that, make sure that you have a plan, okay? And the plan is we're going to declare an emergency with ATC. We've got tremendous situational awareness with the G1000. We've got a large color moving map, shows us exactly where we are, shows us every airport within however far range we want to select on that. Knowing the capabilities of the equipment, you press the nearest button on the G1000, it gives you the list of airports with the approach that they have, with the weather, with the runway lengths, the whole bit. So no reason that you couldn't develop a plan very quickly. And my plan's going to be I'm going to declare an emergency. I'm going to start heading for Oakland. And what's the first thing the controller is going to do? They're going to descend you to the minimum altitude. Okay? That's where you come back and you say, no, I don't want to descend to the minimum altitude. I want to stay at 8,000 until I'm a lot closer to Oakland. And maybe as you get closer to Oakland, if you're still at 8,000 and everything's still going, you might even want to look at another airport then. In this case, we have Livermore, which is another 20 miles to the east, which is VFR. But do we want to give up that airport that's underneath us? That's where you have that plan, and you have to act decisively when you do that plan.
And a lot of those decisions are best made before the flight. And we talked about this a little bit, you know, playing the what-if game. And, you know, we don't do that enough. But, you know, looking at the flight, what are some of the things that could go wrong? And if they do, what is going to be my plan? Because, you know, panic is going to overtake you. And if you've never dealt with this before, you really don't know how you're going to respond. All of a sudden, the tunnel starts developing, and you lose your big picture perspective.
Or it could go the other way, where you don't even realize how serious this is, and you kind of lackadaisical. Well, maybe I'll just head over there and check it out. Or no, you got to go back and get that plan going.
Yeah, I think to what you said, John, exactly. To just declare an emergency and tell the controller, "I think I'm losing oil." That's not going to mean much to him.
Right.
He's going to say, Roger, what would you like?
Exactly.
You need to tell him what you want. Because, and if you say, I want to land at Oakland, well, he's going to try to fit you in the Oakland traffic.
Right.
You say, I don't want to fit in the traffic. I want to land at Oakland as soon as I can.
And it may be opposite direction to their flow. If you want to come in straight in over the water and they're landing 2-8, well, I'm really sorry, but you're going to have to turn a localizer around. And
yeah. I mean, he'll do whatever you want, but you have to tell him.
Exactly.
You have to be assertive.
And if you don't tell him, then he's going to do what he wants.
Yes, right.
Exactly.
And that's human nature. I mean, once again, he has a job to do, you have a job to do, but that's the relevance of the E word. You know, when you declare an emergency, it removes all doubt, moves you to the front of the line, which is where you want to be. You know, get on the ground and sort out the rest of that stuff, but that's not a problem. But, you know, let's think back to pilots and the way that we pilots are made. And, you know, we are eternal optimists. And I think it would be real easy in this situation to get lulled into, hey, this is not a serious situation. I'll just press on. And the downside to that can become a huge, huge snowball. And how do we overcome that inertia that is kind of built into pilots to, you know, get to the destination. How do we overcome that?
Go, no-go points. When you guys were flying at the oceans, you'd have your point of no return.
True.
If you approach that point of no return and you say everything's good, winds are good, fuel's good, and everything, we're going. In this case, we had a point of no return when we started looking at that oil coming out. And all of a sudden, our focus is a lot closer. So we got to start thinking about what we're going to do right now instead of pressing on. So that point of no return just came to right here, right now.
We also, in that regard, published and monitored what we called rim alternates. As we went across, we might pick the Azores or Iceland and say, okay, now that's the closest alternate. And, of course, the nearest button on the Garmin 1000 will do that for you.
But it's not always a suitable alternate.
Correct. Well, we would keep a running tab on the weather at those places so that if we had to make the decision, we'd already done our homework.
And it's a lot easier to make the decision when you've already made the decision, when you know what your decision is going to be. And your decision in this case is going to be to head for the airport that's suitable, that's got the long runway, that's got the lighting, that's got the crash fire rescue stuff. And it's not really your problem. As you said, Bob, if there are, and there will be one or two other airplanes in the Bay Area probably flying around, that's not your problem.
Yeah.
That's somebody else's problem. Your problem is to get your airplane to a point where you can do something about it.
One other issue that we just touched upon but didn't explore, I don't think, fully, was the risk of engine fire and oil burns. One thing you might consider doing in this situation is reducing power. Perhaps if you have the altitude to give up, reduce it further and start a slight descent. Cool the turbocharger and the exhaust system, which is probably going to be your source of ignition in this kind of situation.
Rich in the mixture, perhaps.
Rich in the mixture, cool the manifold down. Whatever you could do to cool the engine down will be
because the turbocharger, if the turbocharger seizes, it can catch fire also from lack of oil.
Absolutely. To see a turbocharger at night, you'd be amazed what it looks like.
Yeah, they glow.
In a twin-engine turbocharged airplane, you can see the glow through the louvers on the engine cowling,
Well, one of the points you built into the scenario, I think, is interesting as well, because you talked about the quick pre-flight. And here you are now wondering whether or not you checked that the oil cap was securely on. You know, the importance of a thorough, comprehensive pre-flight done with a checklist would have eliminated the anxiety associated with wondering, oh, boy, did I screw up? You know, was this something that I started off with that I didn't need to?
But, you know, here's a nice new airplane. It's well-equipped. The pilot flies it on a regular basis. He's had a busy day at the office. He just needs to jump in and run up to Ukiah so that he can get to the hotel. I mean, how many times have we just done a quick walk around? And how many people really use a checklist for a pre-flight on the airplane they own?
Or if you get interrupted in the middle of it, go back and start at the last known place on the checklist and keep going.
But if you do a thorough pre-flight and then pick up your checklist and confirm that you've done all the things that the checklist says, that would have eliminated one variable in this pilot's decision-making process and may have prevented the whole incident, by the way, in case it was the oil cap. So it's an easy thing to pass by, but
I'm amazed at the number of pilots that have the checklist or for sissies mentality. And it's just so contrary to the environment that I flew in, and I know, Wally, you flew in. I mean, here you have the people with the most experience, and every single thing that we did in the military and in the airlines was done with a checklist, and you wouldn't think about doing it any other way.
Right.
And yet in general aviation, especially people that have their own airplane, and I know you get comfortable in a routine so that you don't need the checklist anymore, but the peace of mind with knowing, you know, that I've been there, and, oh, wait a minute, I did have oil put in there, and sends you back to a key point that you really wish you had the answer to at 8,000 feet. It's a worryment that you just don't need. The other one is on the plan that we're going to do here, and it means shooting an ILS to very, very low minimums. Not a simple process. It's something that you train to do, but when was the last time you trained to do it? And at minimums, you need to be real good. You need to be very precise. And if you're nervous, if there's stress, what do we tend to do? We tend to overcorrect. And next thing you know, you got yourself a little roller coaster. And here you are knowing that you want to get it around the first time, and you're chasing those needles all over the place. So what I'm leading us to is the need for practice, 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 so that we're real good when we need to be real good.
and realistic practice. So much of our instrument practice, especially when we do an approach under the hood, which is the way most people get their instrument practice, you get down to minimums or the decision height 200 feet above the ground, and the safety pilot instructor says, take a look up, okay, go around. How many people actually make a landing out of that, like a touch and go, and see what it takes to transition that last 100 feet or 200 feet, get the airplane slowed down, land on the center line, and do that transition too. So that's a biggie that is not often practiced.
In the mode of avoiding this scenario, and I know, Wally, you have some strong feelings about single-pilot IFR at night. You know, not inherently dangerous, but is it for everybody? So I think that's a good finishing point here. I mean, here you are in a situation that you created, you know, the situation, you know, not the oil, but you've placed yourself in this airplane at night by yourself.
In my case, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to avoid that by planning. My personal minimums say I'm not flying single pilot IFR at night. I don't practice at night. I'm not proficient at night. And I just think the workload can get way more than I want to subject myself to. There are a lot of people in general aviation world that do it, and it can be safe if they're well prepared and properly equipped to do it. But my personal minimums, I don't do it.
And the other thing we haven't talked about yet in this realm at night, IFR, is vertigo disorientation. Now, here you are shooting an unplanned approach. You're reconfiguring your cockpit. You're looking for stuff. You're looking for checklists. Where are they? And you start moving your head around in that cockpit. You know, next thing you know, you may find yourself in an unusual attitude. And so, yeah, having confidence in your autopilot, well, you know, are you that confident in setting up? Maybe you had the autopilot on, maybe you didn't. You have to set up, you know, just exactly what your comfort level is.
Well, you need to know how to use the autopilot in this case.
It can be a tool, and like any other tool, it can help you, it can hurt you. You know,
a
hammer can be
a, as well.
That's exactly right. A hammer can be a good tool. You misuse it, it hurts you.
So here's a situation where you really need to analyze your risks, take a look at what's happening, take a look at your personal qualifications, and then make the decision and then keep playing what if all the way along.